Hi everyone, and thanks for joining us for another episode of Lit Radio Podcast. I'm your host, Thea. Today, we'll be speaking with Maria Cazzaro-Makin about her latest book, Group Dynamics, and how to achieve effective team dynamics. Dr. Maria Cazzaro-Makin is the founder of the Leadership Psychology Institute and has more than 20 years of experience in organizational development and executive coaching. She combines business and consulting experience and has done extensive work and research in team dynamics. Her book, Group Dynamics, explores the team to trust and trust to team relations between executives and their associates, relating to the familial relations between these members and their unconventional codes of conduct. Thanks, Maria, very much for joining us on Lit Radio Podcast. It's really great to speak with you about your new book, Group Dynamics. So my first question to you is, why did you decide to write the book? Why are you so passionate about this topic?
First of all, thank you, Teja. Thank you for the invitation. As I'm really, really grateful, and thank you for supporting me in all this. Yeah. So, why did I decide to write this book? I'm clearly very passionate about the subject, and I used to be one of those people who used to hate group work. You know, when I was working in a was an employee in organizations, and I'm talking now about the when at the beginning of my career, so in the late 90s, early noughties. So, you know, when they would say, let's have a brainstorm meeting, that used to be my worst nightmare. And I could not understand why, whenever I would find myself in a team situation, I couldn't contribute at all. So I felt I didn't get a chance to speak. And I know I'm an introvert, but I was thinking, surely this cannot just be the only reason. So I got really interested in teams and groups, and I did study them from various perspectives, as a participant, as an outsider, and I've even done the experiment that you know very well of. So when I finally understood how groups operate, and I understood why I was feeling that way, now I'm at a point where I actually find groups fascinating. So that was one of the reasons I got really interested in that. And also, the other thing why I wanted to write this book is that, to my knowledge, the books that exist on teams and groups, they are either too academic, or they just deal with one framework, one theory. So I basically wanted to have a book where you can find all the theories on groups and teams in one place, but also make it less academic and have even examples from my own experience. And having said that, it is for the audience, it's very important that it's clear that I did not write this book from a position of authority, but rather from a position of curiosity. And I'm still learning about groups, and I just wanted to share my experience and hopefully have this as a springboard for constructive discussions, debates, and learning, obviously.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think many people can relate to what you just explained. When you go to a brainstorming session, you just feel like you're never heard on. There is always that fear to share your thoughts.
Exactly.
So it's really interesting to actually understand why that is happening. So my next question would be about the title of the book, which is Group Dynamics with an X at the end. So why did you call it that and not Dynamics with C and S?
Sure. Because I wanted to emphasize the mix, M-I-X. So it's about the mix of people when they get together. And also I was trying to indirectly point to the systemic aspect of groups and teams. So as individual, we're always part of a system. Our family is a system. The gym we may go to is another system. The department we work for. So we're never in a vacuum as individuals. And we affect each other's behaviors and interaction, even when we think we are not. So even, you know, like you and I are talking right now, we do affect each other's responses. So that's why I chose the mix. So it's about, you know, the people, the different personalities that get together. So yeah, that's why I chose that word. I hope that makes sense.
No, yeah, it absolutely makes sense. And I really like how you play it with the words. So yeah, I think it's fascinating. So could you explain, firstly, why group dynamics are so important for any company, really?
Sure, yes. First of all, we would need to define what we mean by effective group dynamics. And the short answer to that definition would be the absence of any pathologies, the absence of any dysfunction. If I can give one example of such a dysfunction would be the absence of trust. And the reason I'm choosing this specific example is because even though there are so many models and frameworks and theories around group dynamics, they all seem to be aligned in this thing that trust is actually the basis. It forms the prerequisite, if you like, of everything else. And Paul Zak, who is a famous researcher actually on trust, and I do refer to him quite a lot in the book as well, he has done research in teams, and he has tangible evidence on how lack of trust can affect an organization. So specifically, just to throw some figures at you, an organization that has trust has 74% less stress, 50% higher productivity, 40% less burnout. So you can see that these figures actually speak for themselves. They are huge, and we can't just ignore them. So this is why effective group dynamics are important.
Yeah, I think those statistics really show how important effective group dynamics are. So you already mentioned an experiment that you conducted previously. So let's talk a little bit about that. So that experiment was to measure trust in leadership team by collecting saliva samples before and after an intervention. So could you share with us what the results of this experiment were?
Yeah, and it's here I need to control myself and not get too excited about this. This was part of my research, and thank you for giving me this opportunity, Teja, to talk about it. To make a very long story short, it was an intervention that took place with the top team of an organization in the retail industry. And my aim was to show how and to have tangible evidence about how doing something with the team, it can actually affect trust. Trust can increase. So, and the reason I wanted to have tangible evidence using neuroscience was because, you know, sometimes, especially in the business world, people refer to psychology or psychobabble and so on. So I did want some hard evidence. So the hormone that relates to trust and that we all release when trust increases is called oxytocin. And it's also known as the love hormone. You may have probably heard about it. So with the help of a microbiologist, we took saliva samples. And I'm making here a very long story, very short. And I am sparing you the scientific facts because there was a protocol, obviously, that we had to follow. So we took saliva samples and measured the oxytocin levels of all participants before the intervention and at the end of the intervention. The intervention lasted for 2 days, and the results were just amazing. I was very nervous at that time because, as you can imagine, I had no idea whether this would work. So I was just, you know, waiting for the results myself. And oxytocin levels increased dramatically on all the participants. And when I can give you some figures, so the leaders' oxytocin before the intervention, it was 2.7 milliliters of concentration. And after, it went up to as high as 29.4. So you can see how dramatic the effect was.
Yeah, you can absolutely see. And I think that was a very interesting part of the book. I mean, when I started reviewing the book, when we first met, that was the first thing that really caught my attention. And I think it's really interesting for people to read in the book. thank you for sharing that. And yeah, I think the results are really amazing. Thank you again for sharing that. So with the pandemic that started 2 years ago, even more than 2 years ago now, we had to start communicating, working, studying online only. So how do we ensure effective group dynamics when working online? Because to be fair, many of us are still doing that. They're still working on Zoom, on Teams. So how do we really ensure effective team dynamics?
Yes, of course. And I think it will continue to be part of our lives, because we have, again, evidence that it works. Under certain conditions, it does work. So for me personally, the pandemic, I have to be honest with you, was like a live laboratory, because, you know, I had the opportunity to study teams, to work with teams, to try new things out and make mistakes and learn from those. So it was like really a live human laboratory of how it's affecting team dynamics. So to answer your question is, whatever we do in physical space, we just have to do more of it. And I will explain what I mean. And I will just pick a few things that stood out for me, because we could just have a podcast just about this subject, to be honest with you. So if we talk, I'll talk about communication. So when we connect virtually, there are so many platforms at the moment, from Zoom to MS Teams to WhatsApp to WebEx to you name it. So not all platforms are appropriate for all kinds of messages. So when a team or a group of people is working virtually, it's very important that they establish a communication charter, be extremely clear and disciplined about what platform they will be using for what purpose and what message. So for example, if I have a very important message, WhatsApp might probably not be the appropriate medium to share this with my team. Or if I need a quick answer to something, a simple phone call might work much better than setting up a whole video conference and things like that. So a communication charter when people work online is actually quite important. One thing, though, that we need to be careful about, and I'm sure you had personal experience with this, is that how the boundaries can actually be really affected, because being on all those platforms, one has the feeling that you're constantly or you're connected all the time. So there you have your individual responsibility as well to make sure you keep your own boundaries. Another aspect of when working online is to make sure that we create a virtual water cooler. One of the things we lose with virtual is the let's call them the spontaneous moments you have in a physical space. So for example, I get up from my desk, I go to a coffee, to make a coffee or to the loo, I see you, bump on you on the corridor, we might have a chat and so on and so forth. We don't have that when we work virtually. So it's very, very important that the team creates those opportunities for those moments to exchange and have conversation, not just about work. And the other thing I would like to share, as I said, there are loads of things. I have just picked up some things that I think are important, is to not to forget the one-to-ones, not for work, but also as a simple check-in. So I was very surprised when I found out that during the pandemic and even after, many managers just forgot, not intentionally, obviously, but because, you know, they were busy with work, they actually forgot to have a check-in with their team members on an individual basis. Again, not for work, but for, you know, that human-to-human connection. How are you? Are you okay? Is everything fine? And so on. And again, it doesn't have to be a long chat, but just make sure you have that regular connection. It's because virtual teams, they don't have a very clear work-life divide, it's very, very important to have that in our mind. So to make sure that we also respect and treat each other's lives gracefully, because we do not know what might be going on in the personal life of somebody. You know, somebody might be on their own, but they might be caring for a parent, or they might be struggling with a child, or no one knows. So that's really, really important. So these are some of the things, as I said, we could have a separate podcast just for that, of the things we need to take care of to ensure effective group dynamics when we work online.
Yeah, I think that's a really fascinating topic, because we had to change the way we worked basically in a second. So we didn't have any time to adapt. So it's really interesting to understand how we can make that work effectively. So yeah, I think that's another interesting point that people can really read about in the book. But then the pandemic didn't only change the way we worked, it changed a lot of things in both our personal and work-wise. So in the book, you also mentioned that it's changed the leadership styles that are used today. So could you tell us how the COVID-19 pandemic changed those styles?
Sure. What we saw from experience, again, on a global scale, and I'm referring here not just to the UK, but to Europe as well. In the very beginning of the pandemic, we saw an increase in extreme styles. So we either saw too much micromanagement or too much of being completely absent, you know, the phenomenon of the absent leader. And they both of those styles make sense, because, you know, the micromanagement style makes sense because I can't control my external environment, so I might as well control the job you're doing. And likewise, the absent leader was I don't know what's happening. I don't know what to tell you. I don't have any new information. So basically, I disappear because I don't know what to tell you. So it was. It did make sense that we saw these two extremes. Thank goodness, people slowly adapted to the situation, and we saw different aspects of leadership styles coming in. So we saw a lot more compassion and containment as well. And when and I'm referring to compassion, because that's very, very important, because there was a global survey, by the way, conducted by Mercer, and they found that the majority of the 270 or something like that insurance companies that they surveyed, they now rated mental health as being as much of a risk as smoking. So this is huge. So, and that's another indication why we really need to have that compassion, to pay attention to the well-being of our people. And it's not just a nice to have thing. And I think the trend is already shows that we will have employee assistance programs. Probably they might become mandatory eventually. I really don't know, like health and safety is in some organizations. So compassion is a big thing. And then containment as well. So containment has to do with the ability to observe what's going on, to be able to talk about, you know, the negative emotions and feelings, but also the ability to absorb what is going on around you and providing a sense of stability. So this balance between compassion and containment, I find is really, really important in the leadership style as we've gone on since the pandemic.
Absolutely. I think it's really interesting to see how many things the pandemic changed in just 2 years. So really interesting part of the book as well. All right. But when it comes to teams, there are always some pathologies. So what are the most common ones in pathologies?
This is, again, a subject where we could have a separate podcast on. So I will just name a few. And I will name a few which, in my experience, I see quite often happening. One of them is, the name is covert opposition. And what that means, and I will give an example, is the following. Let's assume there is a group of people, a team of people, they have a meeting all together and they agree on something very, very specific. Okay, we're going to do that. The meeting ends, then we all leave the room or the virtual room. And then let's assume that because you and I have a bit of a closer relationship, I grab you and say, you know what, Teja, that thing that we just agreed in the meeting is not going to happen. That's so I am challenging the decision, but I do not do it in the right time, in the right moment, in the right context. So that actually can, you can imagine how it can sabotage the whole meeting, especially if it's the top meeting and the top team of the organization. Many reasons why this can happen. Usually lack of psychological safety is one of them, which that's another very common team pathology, if you like. And psychological safety is a climate, and I'm again here, I'm borrowing the definition of Amy Edmondson, who is a researcher, and she has done a lot of research on trust and especially on psychological safety with teams. And it's about the ability of taking risks. It's about the ability of feeling safe to speak up. It's about the ability to have constructive conflicts and debates and so on. And all that, of course, includes trust. Another pathology that I'm sure you have heard of is groupthink, where sometimes what happens, a group might be so cohesive, or they may not want to break the eggs or rock the boat or whatever metaphor you want to use, where actually it limits the group's diversity of views. And there are many, many famous case studies on this one. Again, not just organizational, but general. So these are just three, if you like, team pathologies. As I said, there's a whole list of them.
Yeah, I'm sure on that, absolutely. And then another topic that you're really passionate about is high performance teams. Yeah, and I know that's you're on a mission to debunk the myth that high performance teams actually exist. So yeah, my question is, do they actually exist? And if not, why do we think they don't?
Yeah, thank you for that. I am very passionate about this. And again, it's and I'm also a stickler for definitions, because again, it very, very much depends on what do we mean by a high performance team. Okay. So and I also have to say that in my experience, the most popular inquiry, if you like, that I have received in the last 15 years from organizations as team and teams is to support them to either become a high performance team, or we are already a high performance team and we want to even become a even higher performance team. So so that has been one of the most important of the most common inquiries. Now, my view is that a high performance team, it's not just a, okay, I have now become one. So in other words, it's not a state that you just achieve. And once you achieve it, I'm forever going to be high performance. I have encountered teams that are high performing in specific instances in time under certain conditions. But to be honest with you, I have to yet meet a high performance team that remains high performance team like forever. So and if you like, if you would like me to throw a few what you call them, characteristics of what we would call a high performance team, these would be the following. So a sense of purpose, having shared values and beliefs, having open communication, ability to speak up, trust and mutual respect, shared leadership, effective working procedures, building on differences, flexibility and adaptability, continuous learning, and self-regulation, which has to do with the team's emotional intelligence. So if there is a team that actually scores 10 out of 10 on all of those elements, I would really love to meet this team. So I hope I'm making sense. And I know that this statement is probably causing a lot of anxiety or, you know, and you know what? I would love to welcome a debate on this. I did try and do a post on LinkedIn the other day and actually ask the question, and I could see how many different people had different views even about the definition. So, and then the other thing that is not helping either with this high performance team concept is that change, and especially as time passes, change happens so often that it's really, really hard to sometimes digest the change. So I work with teams and they may change the general manager or the CEO every 2 years. That even that aspect does not allow for a team to really become high performing, because something changes, but the environment or another person comes in and so forth, that they need to start again. So high performing teams to me is something you really have to continuously work on. It's not just a state that you just achieve and then you say as a team, okay, we have arrived now. I hope I'm making sense.
Yeah, I think you are absolutely making sense. Yeah, and it's just fascinating to see how people understand just one term, high performance teams, and many of us have many different definitions of that. Yeah. So yeah, it's really interesting to hear your point on that. And then my final question for you is, it might be difficult to choose just three, but what are your top three tips for effective team dynamics?
Yes, thank you. It's three tips. So the first thing I want to say is that the way an organization is looking at its financial profit and loss, you know, the P&L statement, and they do that every, I don't know, probably the finance people that do that, look at that every month or every 3 months or whatever. In the same way, an organization needs to be examining its emotional P&L and ensure that it has in place the systems and processes necessary to have this healthy environment. So and I use always the same metaphor, we do take our cars to an MOT every year, and ourselves, we go to the GP to have an annual health check. Organizations and teams are actually no different. So to me, that is definitely, if you like, one of the big tips that everybody should be doing. Another thing is they need to spend some time on reflection. So what I mean by that is, you know, when a basketball or football match is taking place, everything is happening really quickly and so on. Players must make decisions on the fly, foresee the opponent's moves and so on and so forth. So at that point in time, each team's coach or manager is usually at the sidelines observing or shouting the odd comment. However, when the game is over and the teams eventually review the game on replay, that is when reflection and learning takes place. They look at a possible mistake. They look at how they can learn from those mistakes and be better at the next game. So in the ever so fast changing corporate environment, teams, and especially top teams, seem to be devoting less and less time on reflection. So that, to me, is a big tip, if you like, is a big must. The higher up you are in the organization, the more time you need to spend on reflection, because it's from that reflection that you become better. You review, you know, you pull the brake and see, okay, what am I doing? Where are we going? Are we doing the right thing? And again, those reflection sessions, they don't have to be long. It can be just very quick, as long as they happen often, because leadership is a reflective practice at the end of the day. So that would be another tip. And part of reflection, there's something else which is called self-regulation. And self-regulation, as we know from Daniel Goleman, who has done the work on emotional intelligence, is one of the very important parts of emotional intelligence. So, and it has to do with the ability to regulate one's own moods, feelings, and the ability to respond after some critical analysis instead of reacting. So that's no different at a team level. So exactly as we do that at an individual level, and a team needs to be doing that at a team level as well. And that can be part of reflection. I hope that makes sense.
Yeah, it absolutely does. And I think those were great tips. And thank you very much for the whole conversation. I think we discussed.
Thank you, yeah. It has been a pleasure.
Absolutely. I think we discussed very interesting points, and people, of course, can read more about in your book, Group Dynamics. So thank you very much for taking the time to join us today.
Thank you, Teja. Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us today, and thanks everyone for listening. Don't forget to keep an eye on our social media at Lit Publishing on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram, and at Lit Business Media on LinkedIn for more information about new books and podcasts with thought leaders. See you next time on Lit Radio Podcast.